of any decline in English and even European physiological sciences. For myself, a citizen of a small country, where the exercise of the scientific profession is more difficult than here, your personality, your activity, is really a matter of pride and a reason for hope. All the members of the Physiological Society know that they are the heirs of a precious tradition that you have much contribute to create. I am sure, Sir Henry, that you will allow me to say a few more words to Lady Day. Anyhow, French-speaking people have some privilege in this matter. All of us, dear Lady Day, are by experience perfectly aware of two facts. The first, that you have preserved around your husband a sympathetic, white, and refreshing atmosphere without which there is no true rest for an active scientist. And the second, that being the wife of a physiologist is not always an amusing job. Either the day has been dull, the wonderful, crucial experiment has failed, and the scientist returns home in very low spirits. Sometimes, too rarely, he comes back very excited. He has got something to talk home about, but what does it mean to wives? These far-fetched speculations on cats, rats, amines, esters, ganglia, or electrodes. I remember the short conclusion of my sensible own wife after her first big congress. These people, she said, are certainly a very strange fauna. When the physiological husband invites one or two friends home, shop talking goes on all the time. All wives have infinite patience with us, and I must have a generous share of the success. Thus, in this happy occasion, we cannot dissociate Sir Henry from Lady Day, and I invite all of you to drink to the health of both of them the wine that may be left in your glass. To your Sir Henry and Lady Day.
Associated with him. hence the item reminiscences on our menu. I therefore have much pleasure in announcing that Sir Henry is now open for discussion.
Everybody must be wondering who's going to get that job. He said, well, why don't you write and suggest yourself? And I said, well, I can't very well do that. And Byrne said, well, you take my advice. You read a paper by Dale and Richards, another one that he put my name on, and then you write to him and suggest yourself, and he'll invite you to come and have a talk with him about it. And then he'll ask you what you'd like to work on. You tell him you'd like to work on histamine and capillaries, and all will be well. I took that advice, and I so got the most exciting 7 years of my life, 1927 to 33, when I worked in F4. I found in a drawer the other day a list of the people who worked there at that time. And I've got a copy of it here. And I think that Dr. Henry himself, at any rate, might be interested to hear some of the names. And I'm sure there are all of them people who would like to have been here tonight and remember very happily the time they spent in F4. When I arrived there, it was Dr. Bodo. I listened a lot of time to the conversation of Dr. Bodo, but I'm not going to repeat any of it to you now. There was Feldberg and Schilf doing some sinister experiments in that little room at the east end of F4, which I never really understood the real purpose of. But they went away after a bit. Feldberg went away for 5 or 6 years and then came back, And I was able to use that room for 10
pounds.
A.M. Richards was there, taking up all the attention of Colliston. I often used to hope that I could get some opportunity of collaborating with Collison, but he was busy with Dr. A.N. Richards making an apparatus for measuring the oxygen consumption of rats. And I used to watch them fascinated, and I didn't realize at first that they didn't like being watched. But after a bit, I thought I could see a way of getting round their difficulties that they hadn't seen themselves, and I ventured to say something, and I very soon discovered that I wasn't welcome at all. It wasn't until after Dr. Richards had gone that I inherited the apparatus and Collison, and took him along to that little room in the east end of F4 and had quite a lot of fun with it. That autumn, Hans Heusler came for a year, and Walter Bauer from Harvard and Dickinson Richards from New York were there. There was an interesting-looking pump that had just been invented by Dr. Schuster and Dr. Dale for making perfusions, which hadn't been used at that time. I had some opportunity of playing about with it myself, and then I watched the perfusions of the liver, which were carried out at that time. It took about 4 years before that paper was actually written up, but I think that many people here will know of the important paper that they wrote. Hoot came next year, 1928. And there's one point in his technique which Dr. Byrne didn't mention, which I saw, perhaps it was on his second visit to Hampstead, he'd improved his technique because he actually caught hold of Sir Henry Dale's coat here, so there wasn't any chance of him escaping. Charlie Best came over in 1928 for 3 months. He'd been thinking over on the boat what he'd do, and he'd made a list of the apparatus he'd want, and within 5 minutes of arriving in the lab, he'd handed the list of exactly how much glassware he wanted to Collison. He decided to see how quickly histamine was formed in dead tissues. And within about a week, he found that histamine wasn't formed at all, but disappeared. And he got the whole work finished off and the paper written up and went back 3 months later, and I thought it was very quick work. One of the things which I learned that year was that Henry didn't like preliminary experiments. If an experiment was worth doing at all, it was worth doing well. And when it was done well, then that was that. He got hold of some oxytocin, vasopressin, at that time, and asked me to find out what they did. And he provided me with a hen. And I found that it was oxytocin which caused the fall of blood pressure in the hen, much better than vasopressin. It seemed very odd, but it was quite a satisfactory experiment. And then I said I'd like another hen to confirm it, and I was told that the Medical Research Council couldn't afford to go on providing me with hens indefinitely. I'd done a perfectly good experiment, and I didn't say no. Afterwards, when I found that it was the right answer that I'd got. 1928 was the year of the Harvey celebrations. It was 300th anniversary of the publication of Harvey's book on the circulation. And we had a lot of fun in F4 repeating Harvey's experiment. I remember being surprised to find that a snake needed to have artificial respiration when you did experiments on it.
Through
acetylcholine, and for me, the vision of a lobster. Now that was about 1934, about 1.5 years after Adolf Hitler had come to power. Now that was also at the time where Andrews and his colleague had succeeded. The idea to be responsible for anesthetizing the lion. And I discussed the problem with Collison and asked whether it wouldn't be possible that I could come when surgical anesthesia was established. But Collison thought, probably it will be a day where you will be invited to come for breakfast at 8 o'clock. Now, fortunately or unfortunately, the lion didn't die but recover. So I don't know how I would have behaved at that day, whether brave or natural. But I think what is more important, we still do not know whether the sweat glands of the lion are supplied by cholinergic postganglionic sympathetic fibers. Now another story, which probably many of you may have heard, concerns the innervation of the sweat glands in men. One day, Sir Henry came into the lab and saw I was very depressed. I was just testing for acetylcholine. And I was depressed because all samples, all controlled samples, were active. Now, Sir Henry watched me for a moment, how I mixed my solutions, which were in a cylinder, and when I shook the cylinder, I used not the stopper, but my thumb. So Sir Henry at once suggested, and suggested rightly, that probably a substance must have been washed into solution from my thumb. And that naturally brought up the question whether acetylcholine occurs in human sweat. So one day, Sir Henry turned up in a new shirt and clean socks and took vigorous exercise playing tennis. And afterwards, I had to extract these garments of Sir Henry, but they didn't contain any acetylcholine. At another occasion, Sir Henry and I perfused the stomach of the dog. Now there, acetylcholine doesn't appear only on stimulation of the nerve, but also in the resting condition. And one day, I went very excited into Sir Henry's office and said, I have a brilliant idea. Could it not be that that resting output of acetylcholine arises from the ganglion cells in the wall of the digestive tract? And if so, if we were to paralyze these ganglion cells, say with nicotine, this resting output might disappear. Now, Sir Henry said, a little why I didn't understand at once, ironically, that's really a very, very fine idea, but before you do this experiment, you better look up a paper in the Pflugerarchiv, volume 223. There you find the paper in which it has been suggested, this idea of yours, and not only suggested, but tried out and found not to be correct.
So I asked Sir Henry, do you by chance remember? Was in 1927. The first time I came to England was in 1925, and I worked first with Langley and then Sir Joseph Barcroft. In 27, I came to London to work for the first time under Sir Henry, and it was later when I came again, and that was 33. When I came again. Now, I remember when it's his first time I came to England, I had not the faintest idea how to do experiments. And a beginner, I was always interested, how many experiments do you need to establish effect? And I got different advice, and I might say what Langley said. He told me, now if you get five times the same result, and then the sixth time you get a different result, you have to do another 12 experiments. And I remember Sir Joseph Barcroft,